This is One Universe at a Time. I'm Brian Carberline. If you're a scientist and you make an important discovery, how do you spread the word? For that, you're going to need media. Television, radio, newspapers, and the web. So how do you actually do that? How do you get people to understand what you've seen? Today we're going to talk with Mike Johansson, Senior Lecturer of Communications at Rochester Institute of Technology, about how you communicate news and how you can compete for attention in a world with diverse media. So if I understand correctly, your background is in communications, particularly journalism and newspapers?
Yes. 25 plus years, mostly in newspapers in New Zealand, Australia, and here in the United States. First 5.5 years as a reporter and the rest as an editor.
One of the things I've noticed in my own experience, when I mostly do blog stuff, so I'm trying to communicate scientific ideas, but on the online media, and there are times when it's very easy to get disheartened. So, you know, you'll see things with link bait headlines and things that are incorrect that start getting spread over the news, and, you know, something goes viral and then you have to try and counter it. And there's all of these challenges and problems that you seem to come up against. And one of the central things that I wanted to try and ask about is, how do you deal with this? How do you communicate well or clearly in a world in which everybody has a short attention span and they're looking at cats on their phone?
It's the old push and pull. It's been around ever since any kind of media has been out there. You're trying to get people's attention. So you do need to do things that will grab people's attention. And the simple answer is that over time, people figure out that the New York Post, for example, uses headlines that exaggerate wildly. And that's what they expect from the New York Post. But the internet is so relatively young that people are still taking almost everything they see on the web verbatim. It takes them a while to figure out that TMZ, for example, is, you know, as often wrong as it is right. Or, you know, Gawker tends to exaggerate. BuzzFeed tends to focus on one little detail out of hundreds. It takes a while for the audience and the medium to mature. To get back to the question, how do you stand out and how do you take care of issues when they show up? Well, one is just keep pointing out to people that XYZ site doesn't have it right. The headline's not based on the story. The story's not based on the science.
So the fighting back idea. They come in and then you attack them.
Well, you attack it, but you just keep pointing it out. Just keep chipping away at it. And that can be a long and slow process. Another thing to do is to try and get sort of a horde of people on your side, if you like, to jump into the fray in the comments area. You know, great story. Okay. Wish it was based on the science. That kind of thing. here's a link to the real science. And if you do that often enough, people will see that XYZ site isn't to be trusted when it comes to a science story, for example. It is a challenge. You do need to get attention in the first place. And one of the things that's missing a lot in journalism, and I suspect in the blogging world a lot, is sort of the professional editor approach, if you like. Mm-hmm. In other words, the editor's job traditionally is to find out, make the story as good as it can be, make it as interesting as possible, best facts, most interesting facts at the top, and inverted pyramid kind of style.
Right.
But it's all got to be accurate. And then come up with a headline that not only encapsulates what the story is about, but makes you say, hey, Martha, I've got to read this right now. I don't care if I'm late for the bus or I'm late for the train or whatever. I've got to stop and read this right now.
Right.
And that's the challenge. What you've got on the web, though, is far too many people who are just throwing out headlines, as you say, clickbait.
10 things about the sun. You will not believe number 5.
Yeah, right. Have to see what this celebrity did with their swimsuit, all that kind of, yeah. There are there's all kinds of websites and blog posts out there that talk about, you know, ways to make sure you have a clickable headline.
Right.
And they all come down to sort of the same things that advertisers have known forever. Numbers work, questions work, challenging people to, you won't believe this, or this is impossible, but it's true. That kind of very sensationalistic, like the New York Post, perhaps.
Right.
Like a lot of tabloids, they're in the business of just grabbing attention, almost at the cost of anything else. But look at what we think about when we think about tabloids, supermarket tabloids, and the New York Post. You know, we don't hold them in very high esteem. So the other part of this is, do we want to spend a lot of time and effort straightening things out on some sites when they get it wrong?
Right.
Or just we don't let them just sink into the morass of the web?
I know in my own experience, the blog posts for me that are the most popular are the ones where either I'm pointing out someone else's mistake or I'm griping about the state of what people are doing. So it's the frustrated posts that become the absolute most popular. They're the ones that go viral, which is frustrating because, you know, I want to talk about the real science.
That's where you need to tap into sort of an editor. One of the things that editors forever, and I know I had this experience myself, dealing particularly with younger reporters, was they'd come back with a ton of information and have a hard time sometimes distilling what's the most interesting nugget here? What's the hook, the thing that's going to grab someone's attention? The frosting that gets people to eat the whole cake. And you have to think about it in those terms. And you know, you don't ever want the frosting to be misleading.
Right.
You know, you don't want lime frosting necessarily on chocolate cake, but they have to work together. You know, and they have to, one has to reflect the other kind of thing.
Right. And then as a scientist, it feels somewhat kind of antithetical to science. You know, it's like we hate these link bait titles. We hate the idea of, you know, here's a wild claim, and we want to make the cautious statement. We want to make the evidenced statement, which is not what necessarily anybody will read.
Well, but I think there's a happy medium there. You need to sort of figure out, do you want people to read it at all?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, honestly, you know, I've seen some academic papers that almost scream, don't read me. You know, there's a 35-word title. You know, there's the synopsis underneath is a 67-word paragraph. It's a single sentence, but it's 67 words. And it just says, I'm doing it this way because I don't want you to really read me. I'm getting some kind of grant to do this work. I'm going to put it out, but I'm hoping no one reads it.
Well, that's actually a big thing. I mean, in science, you'll have a well-read paper might have 20 readers.
Yeah.
So if you actually write a research paper and 20 people read it and one person cites it, you've won. You know, that's a success in science, and in journalism that would be an abysmal failure.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And but somewhere in there, there is a happy medium. You know, if I could do anything to, I think, improve people's general impression of academics, it would be to help them understand that doing the research and writing the paper is not the end game.
Okay.
The end game is getting more people to understand why what you found in your research is important and how it relates to real-world issues, real-world problems, how it relates to me. One of the concepts I teach in all of my public relations and advertising classes is everyone's favorite radio station is WIIFM, What's In It For Me. And we're all self-interested. We only pay attention to things that we have an interest in. Sometimes it's enlightened self-interest, but it is self-interest. We think we're too busy to spend time on things that don't have any value to us.
Right.
So therefore, you've got to very quickly, in 5 or 10 words in a headline, on the web, on a paper, wherever, you've got to be able to convey to someone why they need to stop what they're doing and pay attention to this.
Right. And you see some of that now in terms of funding. So, for example, the National Science Foundation and other organizations, when you put in a proposal, part of what you have to do now is to describe how you're going to communicate this beyond academia. And that's part of it. But there's still kind of an attitude of, oh, yeah, that's the other thing that I have to do that has nothing to do with science.
Here's what I would argue is that if science is just off doing its own little research and off doing its own little thing, and it's not being conveyed to the great unwashed masses what science is doing, what is the value of that? And where will the money for future funding for grants come from if no one sees value in what's going on over here in science, that they're too busy being scientists to be bothered telling the rest of the world what they're actually doing?
This is One Universe at a Time. I'm your host, Brian Corberline. We've been talking with Mike Johansson about how to communicate science in a world of media. Up next, we'll talk about how media has changed and how we can adapt to it. So you've been in this field for, 25 years?
Oh, more.
More actually, than 25 years, okay.
An apprentice right out of high school in December 1977.
Okay, so it's been a while.
Yeah.
So you've seen things. You've seen this game change.
Oh, absolutely. And a lot of things have changed. The technology, obviously, have changed. The way we get our news, the way it's printed, that kind of thing. The web, obviously, cell phones and smartphones and all the rest of it. But what hasn't changed is the need for the news to get found. And this is a big debate in journalism, particularly, is that up until the web, the news had to find a way to get found. In other words, it had to be distributed in something.
Right. A lot more medium that had to actively go out there.
Right. Now, with smartphones, we almost have an expectation as consumers that the news will find us.
Is there like a difference between push and pull?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah. So media was very much push, going all the way back to the early newspapers, early magazines, advertising on billboards and posters and so forth.
Gutenberg.
Yeah. Well, exactly. It was push. You put it down and you handed it to someone. You delivered it to someone.
Right.
With smartphones and the web, we can set up RSS feeds. We can set up alerts. We can follow a Twitter feed or make a Twitter list of people who share good stuff, and the news finds us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big change. In that world, the latter world here, where news has to find us, sometimes the things that rise to the top of that are the things that have those grabby headlines or have the things that really scream for attention.
Right.
Or
the more sensational the headline, the more people are going to grab onto it.
Yeah. I mean, the Facebook algorithm, for example, is set up so that when I log into Facebook, I see things that I've indicated an interest in according to Facebook's algorithm. So the people I have reacted to the most, the posts I've reacted to the most, and the topics I've reacted to the most, pretty much in that order. No one knows the way the exact algorithm works. Right. But if I don't react to you on Facebook for a couple of months, I'm just going to stop seeing your stuff until for some reason your birthday comes up or something. You pop back up.
Right.
You get pushed down. And that type of thing, it happens in Google search. It happens, you know, it's this sort of popularity contest mentality really is everywhere on the web.
Right.
And, yeah.
And it seems like it's more of a narrowing of the scope. In other words, that the winners continually win in that sense. So the people that you like more or view more get on your screen more and are therefore more likely to get another like or a share from you again.
Right. And it's going to get worse. Facebook just announced a couple of weeks ago, you can now go into your feed and say, these are the five people I want to, everything they do, I want to make sure it shows up at the top of my feed.
Right.
Here are 10 more people I'd like to know about when they post. And so you can, self-selecting, there's a lot of political theory around this, why, you know, the government has become so polarized, is because you can listen to a conservative radio station, because all your friends and your social networks can all be conservatives, you really start to get a world view because you're surrounding yourself with just like-minded people.
Right.
And there is
true with any group. You can build this kind of echo chamber and
sure.
You think the entire world thinks like you.
Right. And even if the people you're surrounding with represent 10% of the population or 15%, whatever it is. What is interesting, though, is there was research that came out, I believe it was last year, reported on NPR, Shankar Vedantam. He reported on social science a couple of studies that found that even though people are surrounding themselves with like-minded points of view, they're actually still unable to avoid contrary points of view. And that even if you do nothing but listen to conservative radio, go to conservative websites, you still cannot avoid being exposed to opposing points of view.
Because at the very least, people are going to gripe about it.
Right. And so there is some hope that you still will not be able to be in a complete bubble of your own point of view.
So I think one of the things you talked about in terms of how we see media, you said before we were having the conversation, you can break people up into skimmers, dippers, and divers, is
yes,
that right?
Yeah. So back in the day, I was working for a large media corporation here in America. I was on a committee that was looking at, you know, how the web might change things. And one of the things we decided was that if we were putting together a Peterson's Field Guide to Birds, and that if all web users were birds, they'd be categorized as skimmers, dippers, and divers. Skimmers being the people that call up, do a search in Google, and they just read the headlines and the search results. They'll often be the ones that go to a second page of results. Not too many people do that, but they will. Dippers are the people who will read the headline, and they'll read some of those highlighted paragraphs, the key
like
block
the first
of text
paragraph of an article
that shows up, and it's still in the search results. They're still in the search results page. but they're actually reading just a little bit more. And then the divers are the people who actually click on a link and spend at least 30 seconds reading actual content. And the somewhat disheartening thing at the time, although I believe this is still true, is our very unscientific survey found that 80 to 85% of people doing Google search are the skimmers. Mm-hmm. And they would just skim, and they may dive into one result. Another 10 to 15 are dippers, and somewhere around 5% or a little less are actually divers, the people that will actually go deep into something on the web. So if you're producing content for the web, what you have to do is get skimmers to become divers. And the only way you do that is a headline that grabs attention, that key paragraph that really scintillates, excites,
right.
makes you stop you doing whatever else distracts you from whatever else you were going to do.